Welcome to the Lord of the Rings Lorecast, the show that explores the background of Tolkien's amazing world from the very beginning. Welcome back to the Lord of the Rings Lorecast. I have with me this week our patrons. This is our second official VIP patron chat, and I'm excited. It's growing. We have three VIP members with me this week in order to discuss if we could ask Tolkien one question, if we could send it back in time, or if we could, I don't know, bring him back from the dead. That sounds kind of gross and weird, but if somehow we were able to get a question to him and he could answer our question, what would we ask? Because I know so many of us have so many questions. Sometimes the standard stuff that comes up all the time, like who is Tom Bombadil? Or maybe there's something that you've been wondering that doesn't get asked very often, but it's still a really interesting question. And with me this week to discuss this, we have Azel Razzle. Welcome. Azel, how's it going?
Very good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad you're able to make it. And then we have Daniel Nightweaver joining us. Welcome.
Yeah, good to be here.
And Aldarion was right. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Aldarion, you, in the pre-show we were talking, and you said you had something I think is very interesting that you would ask Tolkien. Why don't you go ahead and explain to everybody what your question is, why you're asking the question, and then we'll kind of speculate about maybe what he might answer. So what were you thinking?
So my and kind of initial thought when we brought up the topic, and I think I've asked it before in the comments, was kind of like, he had any intention behind breaking up his, you know, world and into different, like there were different ages the way he tells the story. And if that was somehow, you know, kind of a reflection of like the evolution, you know, of humanity in a sense of the, our technological evolution, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because you have kind of the before, you have before time even existed at all. Then you have the making of the world and you have the before there were ages part, which is who knows how many hundreds of thousands or millions of years of the crafting of the earth and the initial conflicts with Melkor and all of that. And then you have the first age, the second age, the third age, a fourth age, which he even started writing a story about and then gave up on. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. It didn't go very far. But then he also speculated in some things that this was like eventually his world would have evolved into the world that we're living in now. And that would have been like old history, that sort of thing. So yeah, that's an interesting question. I have some speculation. I think there are a few different things that might answer that question. You said it kind of reflects our own ages of the world. Are you thinking like the Bronze Age or the Stone Age or like the Iron Age, things like that?
Exactly. I know he was obviously a big, you know, he was history, you know, was a big part of his, human history, that is, it was a big part of his influence. And he was very much thinking when he was writing about like the reflection of our own past and how he could pass that on through his stories. So I would assume that it did in some way have some influence, but yeah.
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, it's a categorizing feature, right? Like he was an academic, and academics like to categorize things and put them into little, you know, little piles, like this is what happened here and this is what happened here, and divide it up. And of course, reality is always more complex than just like, oh, well, there's not a definitive line between, say, the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, right? Like the two kind of blended together depending on the culture and where you lived and all that kind of thing. So here's some of my speculation about that. I think there's a few things going on. First, I don't know that he even intended to get into the later of the ages of the world initially. I think that the first age was kind of, that was the world. And then the story branched out bigger than he was expecting. And especially once he got to writing The Hobbit and then realized that The Hobbit was in fact going to be part of his greater mythology. And so he had to place it in that world in a place that made sense and therefore spawned the third age and had to come up with, okay, well, why is the world the way it is during the time of The Hobbit? And then you have the invention of a Dark Lord and the downfall of that Dark Lord. And then when he gets to the Fellowship of the Ring, he's like, oh, well, the Dark Lord had a ring because the Dark Lord was amassing power again. So there must have been a second age where he fell at the end of the second age. And I have a feeling he kind of worked backwards from that when it came to the second and third age. But I think that ages of the world also have to do, like, you can, if you study religious texts, even in the Old Testament, there's a lot of language around ages, the beginning of the age, the end of the age, and that kind of language. You find it in the Gospels too. In fact, in the Gospel of Matthew, he talks a lot about how the kingdom of heaven will come to earth at the end of the age, and that kind of language. And we interpret that different than early Christians did, but early Christians would have interpreted that as this kind of cyclical pattern, and that being like the ages of the world. You have kind of the there's always a new beginning and then an end, and a new beginning and an end, and that would be the final end, where heaven comes to earth, that sort of thing. So I have a feeling he's probably pulling from that, and like you said, from human history, from categorizing, and a lot of the other stuff. What, let's open this up. What do the rest of you guys think? Do you think that there's other influences on this, or?
Yeah, well, I got intrigued with the biblical references, of course. Yeah, I think there's definitely a piece of that evolution of humanity in that, and the kind of the ascendancy of mankind, the kind of the story of how humans in some ways reached the pinnacle, where elves would seem to have held that position in his universe. And so you can certainly see that piece of the evolution, and just it. Yeah. Like you said, I think it just reflects a lot of our own development and history. And I don't know, I was listening, just thinking of the warning of the ring and how it's supposed to, in his own time, where he sees that transition from kind of that idyllic pastoral world of the green shire-like England into the industrial kind of wasteland that he came to know, and how much he hated that, and it seemed to really influence his notion of what the ring was. Like, almost as the human or mankind is progressing in the story, it almost is like a warning. Like, you can still get to this point. Yes, you may have destroyed the mechanism of the enemy, but like, it still has the power to destroy. And because he's seen that that's the evolutionary step the humans have taken in his own day and age. And you wonder if where that might have led in his fourth story. Like, I remember, I think you had mentioned that in one of the podcasts about some unnamed evil that he was still toying with, and what that might have actually been in the fourth age. Would it have been our own lust for power? Like, would it have gone back and reflected on the old Numenorean story, or the rings and the mechanism of the ring, and our propensity to want to kind of take that next step at the destruction of everything?
Maybe.
And whether that was a positive step or not, I don't know. I can see that at work. And the ring becomes like a warning of, we're progressing, but what are we progressing to?
Right. Yeah. In our own current world right now, there's a lot of, I don't know, nervousness about AI and how technology is developing and what that's going to do to us as human beings, our society, all of that. But that's not new. Every time we've gone through a technological revolution, we have those types of dilemmas. And his was post-industrialization. That's the dilemma he went through. And this idea, and he was very much on the side of, we think this is progress, but it's not. And hey, we would all be better off if we were just, you know, kind of chilled it, you know, with destroying nature to make the world easier for ourselves, or whatever the justification is, to get to amass wealth and power, or whatever is usually the actual reason, as from what he would say. But yeah, I can see that as well. And going back to the question about like the ages of the world, you can kind of see in our own world that oftentimes those ages are divided by the type of technology that was prominent or most potent at the time. That's why we call it the Bronze Age, because it was bronze technology. It was the technology to craft instruments that made farming easier and warfare easier and things like that. And then it continued on. Go ahead. Yeah.
And they're generally marked by huge conflicts. Well, I mean, not like you said, there's not a direct, you know, this is a this day decides the new age, but generally a huge conflict which leads to a lot of technological advancement is where those kind of are demarcations for the beginning of a new age, as it were.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Yeah.
And as I say that, though, I could also imagine the professor being like, it's just a writing mechanism, you idiot. Don't look
yeah.
into it.
Right.
Too deeply.
That was the other thing that popped in my head is like, it's actually very useful as like you said, a writing mechanism to be able to say, well, all of this stuff happened in what we'll call the first age and it ends with a climax. Imagine that you're a storyteller. You're going to end up as the story of the first age was some sort of
might be overthinking it.
Right. It starts with a, hey, everything was fine until, and it ends with there's a big climactic moment. And then the second age, everything's fine until, and then a big climactic moment. So that does feel like something an author would do. But it also, you're right, it also kind of matches history. Like, we go through these phases. Like, you could say, like, you know, when did the ancient world disappear and become, I don't know, the Middle Ages, right? Well, right. Probably the fall of Rome, a big climactic moment, you know, something like right. that, you know? So the classical world, I guess you could call it. Azel, what do you think? Do you have any thoughts about the dividing of the world? And does any of this stuff resonate with your perspective, your understanding?
It has been something I've wondered about in the past, but I don't know if I've really given it too much thought, more so than just the big climactic moments that just kind of like the world wars or something just to be remembered, but change history post a significant event. And, and it's always just interesting just to see what changes and what doesn't changes and what lessons people do and don't want to learn from it. But with all the ideas that have already been said, perhaps it is just a giant culmination of references to religion while at the same time tool for the author while at the same time references to our own history, and it's all just coming together to form the story that we all love.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of times these kinds of ideas are not intentional, at least in my experience, being a creative person who's tried to do a number of different things. Sometimes you don't really think about why you came up with the idea. You just go, oh, that makes sense. And then you just use it. And then it's only post. Yeah. That you have to justify it and be like, oh, well, I guess I was drawing from this. And I guess I was doing like this sort of thing, but you can also see the effect of it on other fantasy authors. I mean, how many other fantasy authors use Ages of the World or video games? You know, like in this age of the world, this thing happened. And then this, you know, it does seem like an easy way to categorize stuff, though, to be able to put things in certain little pockets.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So does that help answer your question, Aldarian? I know we can't call up the professor and be like, hey, we got a question.
There's no hotline to Arda, but, you know, it's kind of like it's just one of those things that I've always thought about. Like, you know, I guess, yeah, his thought on it would most likely be, like Azarazel said, a little culmination of all three things. But I think I think it's interesting, the kind of reflection or, you know, of our own history and the way things have kind of changed.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. It's not something that really came to mind for me, like thinking through this, but that's part of why these chats are so fun, is because we get to have other people jump in and say, hey, I've always wondered this, and I go, oh. That's also why I like when you guys ask questions and post comments on the episodes, is because I you know, I can only see things through my perspective, and so I have to, you know, oh, that's an interesting question, that's a good question, I should address that, people probably want to know that, you know, that sort of thing. So yeah, I appreciate that. Well, let's move on. Who would like to go next? Daniel? Azel? Daniel, do you got something?
I have multiple questions that I would ask, honestly. Sorry. The one that's been kind of weighing, just because I read an article on Substack about it recently, and then I've heard Christopher Tolkien's take on the movies and just everything that's come up of recent within the last 20 odd years, is I wonder what Tolkien's like Papa Tolkien's take on all of these movies, TV shows, animated, all these IPs that have come up over the last number of years. I wonder what he would really think of them. Like, I remember I think it was a It was a bonus episode about Tolkien and Lewis going to see Snow White in theaters.
Right,
That was like one of the best images I've ever had in my whole life. This is the two of them sitting in the theater watching Snow White.
wouldn't that be amazing? I would love a movie that was just Tolkien and Lewis go to Snow White. And it's just them walking to the theater and then them having a conversation in like a coffee house or a bar afterwards about the movie. I would love that because it's so funny to think about.
It really was. I love that image. I think I was driving home and I laughed out loud at that one. But I would just be curious because I know Christopher's take on the movies was like he loathed them. Like he had nothing positive to say about them at all. But I would be curious to know what J.R.R. Tolkien might have thought about these movies that, yeah, Christopher has points, but there's also like it's introduced a whole nother generation to this work that they may not have engaged with at all if it had just been left to his books. And so, yeah, maybe it's not his preferred version, but it still is an introductory point for them. And a lot of them did go on to read the books and engage with the world in a much deeper fashion. Yeah, I would be interested in that and his take on all of that, and even it kind of a secondary question, just because it is part of the movie industry, is whether he saw what he would make of AI and all of that jazz
Oh, I'm
that's
sure.
going on right now.
I don't think he would like it one bit. But here, to talk about the movie thing, I think you're onto something. My gut instinct on this, based on everything I've read and all of that, and his other reactions to Snow White, is that he would hate it. He would hate every little change. In the same way that he would, when he was working with his editors and the publisher, the way that, like, even if they just changed one little thing, like, he has his reasons for why he puts things in his stories, why he writes them in a certain order, why he uses certain words, all of that. And when you have to translate his works to something else, whether it's a movie or a TV show or a video game, I have a feeling he would have just like he would have considered it a, I don't know, a shadow of the thing that he was creating. And but the flip side is what you said. Without that, how many people would have missed out on then becoming fans of his work and then digging deeper and reading the novels and seeing the version of the stories that he wanted us to have? You know, so it is kind of a double-edged sword, you know, like there really is a benefit there, but at the same time, I don't know that he would have stood for it. I think it would have driven him nuts. That's my sense.
Well, I assume that Christopher Tolkien kind of spoke for his father's will on that one. But yeah, he had nothing positive to say, even though it did lead a lot of people to his father's properties and engaging with the work. But he just couldn't, like you said, stand the idea of it being so altered and the elegance of the words being taken away. And they Earlier, we were saying about the ages and whether that was just a plot device or intentional. And I think of the fact that I've heard like lit with him being a literary professor and a linguist in his own right, there wasn't a single word that wasn't intentionally chosen, that everything was intentional from start to finish. It wasn't like Robert Jordan, who I've read and multiple times, and you get the sense that sometimes his world got away from him, and he couldn't quite bring it back. And until it was such a big monstrosity, he almost had to leave things alone because he could never wrap everything up and it properly. With Tolkien, it never seemed like every single word, every single point was intentional, and he knew exactly where this was going to go from. There was no accidents. There was no plot devices left unexplored because it didn't work in the grand scheme of. So, yeah, to watch so much of that have to be put on the cutting room floor would, yeah, probably not have suited him well. But I wonder how he would have reacted to the fact that it did introduce it so many people to his work, though. Like, would he have been appreciative of that fact, or just said no, it stands for itself, or it doesn't stand at all? I don't know.
Well, I know he wasn't big on fame. He didn't do this in order to become famous. To get him to sit down for an interview was always a little bit of a pain. he wasn't in it to be a celebrity. He didn't want that. He did like the fact that people enjoyed his work, and he did like that people would write questions and became even more curious about it. And so he would answer those questions and write letters back and things like that. So yeah, there is a little bit of that. I wonder if having a conversation with him, you could argue from the moral stance. You could pitch something along the moral lines of, but your works have such great moral importance to society. Isn't it worth it to make something a little bit less authentic, but more easily digested in order to bring people into the work, in order to share this moral perspective with them? And he might go, okay, well, that's fine, but it's not the art that I was creating, or something like that. You know,
I think he actually probably would have now taken a little more, or given them a little less creative liberty and involved himself more, is what I would like to think, but also probably cut a deal for like, listen, if you're going to do this, then maybe you allow, we somehow figure out a way to do the, and I know you said before, it would probably be very difficult, but some version of the Silmarillion. Because that he would feel that would be just as important as telling a third age story.
Right. Right. Yeah. The other idea when, Daniel, when you were talking, we as fans will learn something like, Peter Jackson and his team decided to take the lines from this character because it didn't fit in where that part of the movie was. And they took those lines and they gave it to another character in order to convey that information just through somebody else's mouth or whatever. And we as fans go, oh, that's really cool. They're still pulling stuff from the books, but at least it's authentic to the books. That would have driven Tolkien nuts. You know, like,
yeah, I feel that would have easily have done the wrong thing, even though, like you said, I see the benefit having those authentic lines still included in there.
Right.
I don't think that he would have enjoyed at least the different characters saying it, because it would have ruined his meaning behind them.
Yeah, because he would have been like, that was Aragorn's. Aragorn's the one who said that. Why did you give that to Gandalf? That doesn't make sense. Gandalf wouldn't say that. You know, like, he's definitely the kind of thinker, the kind of professor who is, everything is so zoomed in. And every reason, every time he does anything, it's as if he fortifies the ideas from all angles, if that makes sense. Yeah. And so we as fans go, oh, well, maybe he won't like it because of this one thing. Whereas he would probably sit there for an hour and say, well, that violates this. And that also, it also breaks this. And then there's this, the reason why that character in that moment, like the nuance of his argument would have been such that we wouldn't have been able to predict it, but it would have made a lot of sense by the time he got through all the reasoning, that sort of thing. Like, that's the sense I have.
Yeah, I feel it's similar to, as you've been talking recently with Gandalf and Frodo discovering the ring, and the whole idea that he's almost writing in his past plot holes into the story in order to cover them and make them no longer plot holes.
Yeah.
With, Bilbo's story no longer being the truthful story that he told everyone. And it does make me wonder if, like what you were saying with your point there, if that's how he would actually approach this reasoning for why he does or doesn't like something about the alternative medias making new versions of them. But one question I've wondered for that is, would there be at least, I understand a lot of people feel this differently, but books you have your entire imagination to pull from, but would there be a single depiction of any of the scenes or the moments or the characters where he thought, actually, I think I prefer how the Black Gate looks there, or I think I enjoy the livery on Eomer's armor, or something like that. Just something throughout any of these pieces of media, whether that's films or television or games, that he might go, I actually didn't mind how you guys did that, and that was very similar to what I was imagining.
Yeah, the first thing that comes to mind, I think that's an interesting question too, is that like a lot of the things he would have been like, well, like he would have, you know, you bring up a character like Faramir, who is distinctly different in the movies, or Aragorn. He would have been like, no, you did those characters wrong, redo it. But the first thing I think about is the way the items, the locations, the buildings, the armor of Rohan looks. I think is probably one of the closest things to his vision of it. The fact that they were basically Vikings with horses. And the way that that is shown in the film is feels very authentic to me. So I wonder if he would feel the same way. Like the longhouses, the horse heads at the ends, like on the pommels of the swords and on like the head of the, like the helms.
Yeah, even on the helmet and the armor as well. It's absolutely everywhere. And
right.
You've got a point there. He's really sort of depicting that exactly as it's been described in the books.
Right. The fact that like the majority of their forces are on horseback all the time. Like when we say Éomer and his men surround Legolas and Gimli and Aragorn, and they all have spears out, which they would have used, you know, like that kind of stuff. I feel like he would have probably been very, very like happy with, I think. Like that feels the most authentic. And maybe even just like the vision of the Shire, the way the Shire looks, I feel like it's pretty authentic. The round doors, the grassy fields, the farming, the ruralness of it, the bright sunshine, you know, the nice weather, all of that. What do you guys think? I think that's a really interesting question. What parts of the films do you think that he would be happy or excited about? Is there anything else that stands out?
I think for me, I mean, I guess it kind of comes from the movie, but not really. The newest animated, The War of the Rohirrim.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one was it felt very true. It felt very like something that was a little closer. Now, given that it was animated, was, you know, a little more leeway to be a little more exact, you know, with the scenes that they can add in and take out. But I felt like that was, I think that he would have really enjoyed that telling of that story, that men alone story, pretty much.
Right.
I don't know, but I don't know if you guys watched that or enjoyed it.
Yeah, I still on my list. Somebody asked me recently, they're like, have you watched it? And I'm like, you know what? I just haven't. I haven't made time to do it, which sounds crazy because I do a Tolkien podcast, but like I just haven't sat down and like pulled it up and watched it. I haven't watched much of anything recently in like the last few years. I just have kind of moved away from watching a whole lot of things. What do you think, Daniel?
I don't know. I would... The brotherhood or the connection between Frodo and Sam, I think they captured that well, and I think it translated well onto the screen. It was in some ways maybe on the screen it was even more, just because you could see it being played out between the two actors. It was so poignant, and it made you realize again how amazing the character Sam's character was, and their bond of friendship. And I think he would have appreciated the fact that that translated so well onto the screen. And although Aragorn was different, I think there was still that inherent nobility about him,
right?
That
right.
was still very much present. Like, this is a person to want to be like he's just the greatest guy. And I think in both the book and the movie, I think they did well in the movie to emulate. They had his story arc different, on obviously more doubting himself, not nearly as certain about his destiny as he was in the books, but he was still inherently noble and still inherently kingly, even if he wasn't certain about himself in the movie. So I think those two things, and from a personal perspective, Gandalf facing the Balrog, that moment on the bridge, that's a pretty amazing visual. And I don't know if he ever had it fully fleshed out in his mind, but man, that one, just when you read the book and then you see it on screen, it's like, I can't imagine that otherwise.
Yeah, it's pretty solid. A debate about wings. Notwithstanding,
bring up the wings.
Yeah, the score of that moment, I think, would have also been the way it ties in all of that movie magic coming together.
Really, yeah,
it's super super iconic.
Yeah, yeah, and then you bring up Gandalf. I think Ian McKellen, that's how you say it. His portrayal of Gandalf, I feel, is pretty solid. You know,
yeah,
like he's wise. He's patient. He's also grumpy. he's all of the Gandalf things, and he does it very well, and that fits very well too. Heck, even Boromir,
Sauron.
Yeah. So okay. Saruman. Or Saruman, yeah. See, he would have been upset about Saruman's story getting changed, and like the whole end of the book being removed, the scouring of the Shire and all of that. But yeah, I think maybe, yeah. You know, that one's tricky because Saruman went. Nobody realized that he was corrupted until so late, and yet. Christopher Lee's performance is always, there's something just in his nature that comes across a little bit sketchy, like from the beginning, but, you know, maybe that's just a choice of the actor kind of thing. Not really
since the way brought up, you know, kind of the things that he would probably, I think that he would be upset that it wasn't, they couldn't simply find a way to make it much clearer that Gandalf left for numerous years before he returned to Frodo.
Right.
I think that was, for me, that was one thing that stood out initially, you know, that was like, well, that was kind of an oversight. Like, they don't have calendars that you can just change the date on in the background for hobbits or something like that. You
know,
to make it a little obvious. You know?
Yeah, and hobbit lifespans are confusing too. I get the struggles that you go through trying to pitch this to like the average audience who's never read the books at all. And like, you know, to say like, oh, well, Frodo or Bilbo leave on their journey at 50 years old. Like people, wait, what? Like 50? Are you sure? Like not a younger? And it's like, well, 50 for hobbits is not really, but like, you don't have the time to really explain that. You just have to kind of like hope people start to get it, you know, and then cast an actor who doesn't look 50 because, you know, that kind of thing. That's always a little funny.
The other piece, as you were talking, Eldarion, I was remembering the first time I watched the movie, and I really liked it, but I had some reservations about it. That was one of them, how compressed that first part of the story felt. But then also their struggle on Weathertop and how Aragorn warns them how deadly these creatures are.
Yeah.
And then he basically is able to scare them off by himself in the movie. And yet is it not, my memory is not serving me, is it not the Frodo's calling out for Elbereth?
Elbereth. Yeah. That sounds right.
Scares them. It's his use of of her, like calling out for her and the powers of Valinor that scare them more than Aragorn ever did in the book.
Right. Yeah. They had to make changes like that in order to kind of set our, it's so weird. As people who watch movies, we expect every movie to work and function the way the mechanics of other movies work. So you have to set up a character who's heroic with a heroic moment to prove that they're a good guy. So you have, like you have, of course, the, you know, scary introduction of Strider being the guy in the back with the hood and looking all creepy. And then he shows up to save them from the wraiths who show up, you know, to try to kill them. And if you're a movie watcher, you're still going, yeah, but is he bad in another way? So you have to have a moment in certain of the film that goes, no, he's a good guy. He saved their lives and fought back. And he's a badass because he can fight all these ring wraiths. But like when you actually back up and look at it again, you go, wait a minute. Like, how did he fight
with some pillows?
Yeah.
You know, with Jessica Quaid in the middle of the night at one point, like, you know,
right. It's movie logic, but you know, and in the same reason why you would like shortcut the beginning of the film is because the average moviegoer doesn't want to sit there for 20, 30 minutes in the Shire before the story gets going, you know, that sort of thing, which is, going back through the first three chapters of the Fellowship, like it does take a while for things to just kind of start moving because like you guys said, Gandalf has to give his explanations for why certain things are the way they are and why the Hobbit makes sense in this world and all of that. So it is interesting. It is interesting. You bet that living in Florida changes the way I dress every year. During the summer, it is way too hot and humid to not wear something that is light and breathable. And now that I've found Quince, I've been wearing their clothing all the time. I wear my linen shorts as often as I possibly can, and I've been so much cooler even inside the house. I haven't had to run the air conditioning as much, which is kind of crazy. And right now you can get Quince European linen pants and shirts, perfect for this weather, starting at just $34. Their tees are also soft and easy to wear. Lightweight cotton sweaters are perfect for cooler summer nights. They have options for everything. Plus, their prices are 50 to 80% less than similar brands, and they work directly with ethical factories to cut out the middleman, so you're not paying for the markup, you're just paying for the quality. Plus, I've noticed that they have some other things that I'm very tempted to get. Everything from sofas to ceramic cookware, premium bedding, all sorts of stuff. But if I was to recommend just one thing, go get some linen shorts. It will change your summer, I promise. So go, elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/ringslore for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/ringslore for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ringslore. All right. Well, let's. Oh, go ahead. Did you want to? I want to move on to the next question. But if you have more to add,
real last, honest last thing. I think that would have been kind of those little editorial things that Tolkien, well, as he said, Papa Tolkien would have added into these movies to make it very clear that there is a history here that you're
right, missing. Right.
And I think that's kind of, you know, the only thing that probably would have he would have been able to change, because there probably, you know, was a lot going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love to see his version of the movies. It would be like, I don't know, 30 hours long, but it would be really interesting to see what he would put together. But I don't know that you could ever get that funded. I don't think that would work. So, all right, let's move on to Azul Razzle. Azul, do you have any questions you would ask the professor?
Oh, funnily enough, the question I was going to come up with was the same one that Daniel asked about what you'd think of the external media, just because it's not just, you know, the animated films of the last century, or the main ones we know with the Peter Jackson films. It's just spread to video games. It's spread to, I guess, even more artists just drawing the depictions of things, and it's just changed in so many different ways. Like, even with a video game, it doesn't work the same way that a book or a film would, where it has sort of that, it will sort of have the same structure, but there's a lot more external factor coming into play there from the player. So
right,
makes me wonder if he'd be just completely against something as simple as that, even if it is doing the benefit of introducing more people to deeper of his world. And but regards to a completely separate question, not sure I have one.
Okay, that's fair. I mean, that's fine. You're welcome to just kind of hang out and chime in as you want. It sounds like Daniel's got a few other questions. Daniel, you want to toss us one of your other questions?
Sure. Well, I was intrigued of recent. I read an article again, might have been the same person, about how when he was denied this. I think that his name was put up for a Pulitzer Prize in literature. Mm-hmm.
Like, was it the Nobel Prize, the one I talked about Nobel recently? Prize.
Yeah, yeah. That's sorry, right. Not the Pulitzer, the Nobel.
Yeah.
He wasn't seriously. They looked, but they didn't seriously consider him. They thought his writing was unimportant and it belonged in the realm of children's literature, not serious literature.
Yeah, and overly verbose, and the poetry wasn't very good.
It wasn't very good. Yeah. And all the rest of it. And I remember that I don't even remember who was actually won that year. It's not a book I've ever heard of. And then they listed the books that were up alongside of Tolkien's work, and it's just ridiculous. Like, just mm-hmm. a powerhouse of authors who were snubbed that year in favor of this hyper realistic European novel that nobody remembers.
Yeah, yeah. I did an episode, bonus episode about this recently. If I can pull it out of the back of my brain, it was a book about it was the history of Poland or something like that. It was something very, I don't know, domestic in comparison to, you know, like, if that's even the best description, I don't know. But yeah, I get what you're saying, and it is kind of amazing, right?
But my question to him then would be, like, here he's got this world that's obviously lived in his head for so long, and he's polished it and he's looked at it, and he had like earlier versions of the Silmarillion or version of the prehistory long before he'd even written The Hobbit, all that stuff like that. I mean, I love the idea of putting down in paper some of the ideas that float around in my head, but I always think, ugh, nobody's going to want to read that. I would love to just ask him, like, what was the driving force that kept you like motivated to tell the story, even when your peers outside of your best friend were telling you this is literature that's unimportant. Like, you're a serious professor, you're a few of literature and all the rest of it that he did, you're highly regarded. And yet, what drove you to tell this? What ended up being a remarkable and revolutionary type of storytelling? But it would have been so easy for him to say, maybe I'm up the wrong path here. Maybe I should just kind of keep these stories to myself and not share them. I would love to just to ask him that question of what kept you going, like what
Yeah.
propelled you to tell this story, because you changed the world with it, but at the time it didn't look like that was going to happen.
Yeah,
That's a
yeah.
pretty good question.
Yeah, I have some speculation that comes to mind. I think the first piece is probably influence from his children, especially Christopher Tolkien, saying, hey, Dad, the world needs to read these, like get these out there. I think the second piece is by the time Lewis submitted him to the Nobel board, the Lord of the Rings had it was already out for 2 years, I believe, something like that. And in that time, from The Hobbit, he got letters. People would write him, but especially after the Lord of the Rings, if I recall correctly, and I'm sure I can mix some of this stuff up, but after that came out and started building, surprisingly building a fan base, he was getting more and more letters from fans. And if what I do with this show is just a tiny little speck compared to the greatness of what he's done and the kinds of things that you guys or like other people will just send me. Sometimes I get just emails out of the blue. Sometimes I get people signing up on Patreon saying, thank you so much for doing the show. It means so much to me. I love these works. They changed my life. Like, the little glimpse that I can see of the way that people praise what he did, if he was even just getting, any letters that were like that, I would imagine that that probably meant the world to him to hear that like people, the right people were enjoying the work. Like maybe it's the Nobel board isn't the right people. And he knew that like his fellow academics weren't all going to understand because he already got feedback from them and they didn't, not all of them understood, right? But when it came to other people out in the world, I think he probably was like, okay, there are people who understand. So it's worth it. That'd be my guess.
Yeah, I would think. And as you were talking, yeah, just the mutual support, perhaps from the groups he was like, his wife. Oh, why was her name escaping me?
Oh, yeah, names fall out of my brain all the time. Edith.
Edith,
Yeah, I just
thank
talked
you.
about her recently. Yeah.
Yeah, like her support. I mean, seemed like they were just kind of a couple that always had each other's backs, and I just love the fact that on her tombstone, he refers to her as Luthien. But then also the Inklings, like that group of authors he was part of, and like Lewis. And I did a class in seminary on Dorothy L. Sayers, and she was part of that same group, and how much they would have supported each other and encourage one another to keep writing and keep doing what they're doing, because their stories needed to be told. And those kinds of groups would probably go a long way to keep you push you forward and keep tell help you tell your story.
Yeah, I think you're right. The closest thing I can talk about that resonates with me with that, well, two things is being a podcaster and having a network of other hosts, other podcasters, and being able to help and support each other and say, hey, you're doing a great job. Keep it up. Like that is big. But even more so, back when I was playing music, I started playing music in high school through college and then into my 20s and pursued touring with a band, trying to get a record deal, all of that stuff. And if I hadn't had the other musicians, not only in my bands that I'd been playing with, but the other bands we played with as well, if we didn't have this built-in community of what you're doing is awesome, keep doing it, then I don't know that I would have kept doing it. Because I like today, the world is very different. I still plug into forums where musicians and guitarists talk and things like that. And you go back 20, 25 years, and it was very common that most musicians were playing out publicly, that most musicians were getting together and jamming with other musicians. But the advent of the internet, COVID maybe, the ability to just record on your computer or play along with something you've downloaded means that a lot of people are just playing, they're just bedroom hobbyists. And there always were bedroom hobbyists, but I feel like that's almost, it's almost flipped. It's like, if you actually get together with other people and do this with other people, that's rare. And that feels weird. I don't know, like Tolkien, with, like you're saying, without the Inklings, would he have continued working on this stuff? Would he have put it out into the world? Because you're right, that community is important.
I like to think he probably would have been a little less inclined to do it as quickly, but he probably would have. I don't know. I'm sure you guys all have a copy of the Silmarillion, but most of them have a forward that's like a letter to his editor. And in that, he kind of speaks about how this was, in his mind, a way to create, you know, a legendarium, you know, mm-hmm. for England that he felt didn't have one. And I think that was one of the biggest kind of influences or inspirations to keep him, you know, going, to have something that he could leave that was both new and refreshing, to give a little background, you know, a tale of fairy, as it were.
Yeah, yeah, a public reason, like there's public value right. to this, like that sort of right. thing. Yeah, yeah, I think that does make sense. Any other thoughts on this? Azarezo, any thoughts on this one that you want to chime in?
No, not too much for me. I'm just enjoying the conversation, but I do agree with Eldarion now being reminded about that foreword in the Silmarillion. It does sort of tend to mention the lack of sort of fey for England and wanting to make his own. So maybe that was just enough of his drive, as well as the children's stories he would have with The Hobbit as he would making them up before they became published. And I guess just doing all this. But at the same time, it is very interesting that he did just persevere so much in so much depth. It wasn't just a sort of a light draft. It was notes upon notes with different stories all over the place. It wasn't even just a single story. You have Beren and Lúthien, but then you also have these other external ones which aren't even to do with anything with sort of Lord of the Rings, and yet he just kept going and clearly just had that creative nature inside him.
Yeah.
Despite the world of fact and nonfiction.
Right. Yeah. He's not the kind of person who is a creator because he was pursuing it for a career or trying to make a living doing it. He did it, or at least this is my personal perspective. He did it because he could not do it, right?
Yeah.
Like that, like he was compelled to continue writing his stories and writing about his world and going back and revising things. And the picture in my head is he would get done with a day as a professor and he hated grading papers, and like he'd get through grading papers and the first thing he would do would be to put that aside and then turn to his desk with his other writings and then finally be like, okay, now I can relax. And then he would get to like creating more of his world. At least, I don't know how accurate that is as a picture, but it's kind of the way it works in my brain.
Leaps out a window like Indiana Jones and goes home to write on his book.
Right. Yeah. 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 Very much so. I would imagine. Yeah, it is interesting. And also, you know, living back in his time would have been different too. Like, as a modern father, if my son is home, I feel like I should be obligated to give him time and to be available to him. But oftentimes you go back to that time period. And I mean, these trends are always funny to me. This idea that like you go back to even the 1960s or 1970s, and the majority of men would go to the bar after work. That's weird, right? Like, you don't go home and say, like, you've been gone all day working your job. You don't go home to visit your family and spend time with your kids before they go to bed. You go to the bar, you know, like, that's weird. And I'm not saying Tolkien necessarily went to the bar, but there's that feeling of like, he was the man of the house. If he felt like he had a hard day and just wanted to bury his head in creating stories, he probably could do that. And that was socially acceptable at the time, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of funny to think about, you know? So, all right. Any other questions? Any other things, Daniel? Any other things that pop in your head?
So many, but is there anybody else who's got a question? I don't want to monopolize.
Yeah.
I had one.
Sure.
Now that we're kind of talking about this, creation of stories. Who would he like as an author now? Who would he enjoy reading?
That's interesting. That's an interesting question.
Because I assume his reading habits were a little more. He was a little pickier, I would imagine.
Yeah, just sure based so. On.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to wonder, I guess if to reframe that question, I wonder if he would like any of the authors that felt inspired by him. And if so, which ones? You know, like, I don't know that he would like George R. R. Martin, for example.
No, I don't think he would at all.
I don't think he would, because George R. R. Martin is kind of the antithesis in some ways of Tolkien as an author.
I do think he would like the way he has continued the expansion of the audience of fantasy, but I think his work specifically, most likely not.
Yeah. Now I enjoy both, but I enjoy it both in very different ways. I don't expect the same things from both, you know?
I think that he would be, I mean, honored to have Stephen King call him an influence, because I think Stephen King in his own right is quite very influential. And obviously in mass media, a lot of his books have become movies, not quite to the success of Lord of the Rings, but you know, I think that that would be someone that he would say, "Oh, this guy's doing something."
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Yeah, I don't know. What did the rest of you guys think?
That's a tough one. I feel he would, because he is very particular about his writings and he goes very deep into it, and so I feel that there is certain authors, not to put anyone down, where it feels they're a little shallow despite their popularity, that they don't have that depth that other worlds have, and I'm not too sure if he would look down upon that or would want something just as meaty as what his own work is, or whether he would be willing to even enjoy some of the lighter stories of other authors just as much.
Yeah, my guess is that he wouldn't require a story to be massive and deep and even world building. In fact, I have a feeling the work, any of the modern work that he would have enjoyed, might be very distinctly different from the setting and the story, the qualities that he puts in his stories, but would still have features that he found compelling. For example, the repetition of classical themes that show up in his work in maybe in a different format show up in this in another work, or really interesting creative use of poetry. I have a feeling he'd probably be really into that. But I don't know. Like, I think this is a tricky question. I can't, like, I'm trying to think of times that he mentioned other authors favorably rather than critically. You know, for as much as he was friends with Lewis and supported what Lewis did, he definitely had some very critical things to say about Lewis's work. But that didn't necessarily mean that he didn't like it. It just meant that he, you know, as an academic, you can do that. You can say, well, I have a bone to pick about this. I really love your work, but I have a bone to pick about this, you know, at the same time.
And then the fact that he doesn't, what did he tell his students? Don't waste your time with Chaucer and Shakespeare. Go and read the old Icelandic lays.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, that gets very particular.
Yes.
Don't worry about Shakespeare. That guy's a hack.
Right. And he didn't like Dune. Dune was another like massive kind of world. He hated it. And yeah. My sense of that is because stories like Dune do not play the same way with the themes that he uses in the same way. Like they're, one example of this would be the use of a Messiah figure in Dune is very different than it is in, say, the Lord of the Rings. Like that kind of thing is it, like he takes issue with that. Like, I think there's something about his perspective on these things that says there's some shoulds there, you know, like if you're going to have a Messiah figure, it should do these functions. And if it doesn't, it's not, you did it wrong, that sort of thing.
Do you feel that any of the allegory of Dune is also part of the issue?
Probably. I mean, he didn't like allegory. Like, and I mean, that was one of his issues with Lewis's works. He's like Aslan is Jesus. And he's like, that's a little on the nose, don't you think?
Yeah. This is a slight tangent, and I don't know how true it is. I just remember hearing it when the first of the Narnia movies came out, and they were talking about its relative success and But then they spoke about how Lewis, when he wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and maybe it came at a different point in his own faith journey. Don't know his timeline that well, but when he wrote the story, he was unaware of the fact of how closely his story aligned with the story of the resurrection. And it wasn't until it was pointed out to him that he realized that he had created this allegory for Christ in the Aslan figure, something he didn't intentionally lean into from that point on. But when he first wrote it, or so I've heard, he didn't actually know. He didn't intentionally allegorize Aslan as Christ. It wasn't until
Interesting.
somebody pointed out to him, he went, "Oh, okay, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I
Yeah.
did."
Okay, yeah, let me look at the details here. Yep, lined them up. Yep.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Yeah, I guess I did that. But it is interesting, like this opens up all sorts of other doors. Like so much of literature has been influenced by the Bible and Bible stories that he may have been using subconsciously inspiration of other Christ-like characters in stories that he had read, not realizing that what he was then pulling went dated back to Christ. And then, like
Yeah.
if you're referencing something that references something that references something that references something, and you didn't know the original reference, then maybe like, yeah, I can see why that would be accidental. Like you may not even realize it in the moment.
Yeah, he was very intentional about it later. I mean, he was very specific about it, but that's what I heard in the original, so.
Oh, it's interesting, man. Wouldn't it be great to be able to just like sit down and just have a conversation? And I'm sure it would, for all all the things that we can predict and all the things that we can think about, like, well, we've read so much over the years, or we've studied this or that, I'm sure we would all be surprised. I'm sure he'd throw a hot take in current language at us about something, and we'd be like, wow, really? Okay. And then he would spend, like I said, an hour explaining the nuance of the justification. And then we would leave going, okay, all right. All right. I can see that. All right. Didn't think about it that way, but I got it. Yeah. Well, guys, this has been a wonderful conversation. We're getting close to the end here. Is there anything else you'd like to share, or any ways that you want people to reach out to you, or any things you want to put out into the world? I want to go kind of in order here and give you each a chance to just kind of shout some stuff out, or even just like leave us with a question or something like that. Azzle Razzle, I'm just going to go in order on the screen. Azzle Razzle, thanks for being here. Any thoughts? Any
Thank you
last?
again for having me.
Yeah.
I guess I'll, considering some of the topics we discussed earlier, I'll say leave us with a question. What is everyone's favorite age of the ages of the world?
Ooh. Yeah, maybe that's what we should do, is I'll come up with questions to end these episodes on so that we can pick up those questions on the next episode and think about them all month, and then come back.
Yeah,
That's an interesting question.
hopefully more people will join us next time, and then more questions and answers.
Yeah, we've got 30 VIP patrons. So this is just a tenth of the audience. So you're all welcome to join or sign up and join us. Yeah, good question, Azzle Razzle. Daniel, what would you be your question to like pose to the world and like maybe come back and discuss again on a future episode?
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, I mean, a question I didn't ask, but thought of, I mean, how much influence do we not literary influence, but like real world influence do we see trickled into Tolkien's work? Like his experience, not just in industrial England, and the shaping of the world that he once knew, but also, his experience in World War I and all of the horrors he went through. How much of that really do we see on the page when we read Lord of the Rings and the other epic works of his? And how much of it, in some respects, is he even, whether he knows it or not, kind of working, processing the stuff that he experienced in his life, the loss of his England, the horrors of World War I? How much of that is getting expressed in the page that we're reading?
Falling in love.
Falling in love.
Yeah. I mean, you talked about Lúthien on Edith's grave. It seems like the more I study him, the more it seems like he was maybe even subconsciously, but processing the things in his life and putting them into these works. Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm sure there are things that I haven't even thought about. So I would love to hear people's thoughts on that as well. But thank you for joining us again. Anything that you want to leave for people to reach out to you or anything like that? I forgot to ask Azzle Razzle for that, but we'll get back to that. If you want people to reach out, that's fine. But if not, that's fine too.
Yeah, not really at this point. Yeah.
Okay. Azzle Razzle, do you want to give people a way to reach out on social media or just on, I don't know, on the Patreon or whatever?
I'll just say, yeah, if they want to reach out, same name on the Patreon as well as the Discord.
Awesome. And then Aldarion is right. Thanks for joining us this time. I'm so glad you made it. And thank you for bringing your questions and discussion. That was a lot of fun. Any way people can reach out to you or question that you want to leave for everybody?
Nowhere to reach out. I mean, I'm obviously part of the chats here and there. Always happy to discuss things on the Patreon, or I am on the Discord as well. I would say no question, but if I mean, just kind of, I know, referring back to myself, but I was saying one of the bigger epics that I liked that I found after finishing Lord of the Rings was the Dark Tower series by Stephen King. If you guys are looking for a new read, that's it's a good one. That's kind of very different, but very kind of the same. So anyways,
yeah, it is a different type of story, but yeah, I can see where you're like, yeah, I'm kind of, yeah, yep. Yep. Awesome. Well, thank you guys for joining me. Thanks again to Aldarion is right, Azzle Razzle, and Daniel Nightweaver for joining me on that chat. That was always a lot of fun to get together with people and just kind of nerd out about everything. But also thank you to all of our other patrons, including some of the greatest names, Pooj, Eric E, and P, just the letter P. Thank you for signing up. Patreon.com/LOTRLorecast. You can get ad-free episodes. And of course, you can join us if you are a VIP patron on the chats every month at the end of every month, just like this one. Also, if you've left a review and rated the show 5 stars, I really do appreciate that. And if you do it on Apple Podcasts, I'll read out your review on a future episode. But now we got to shout out all of our VIP members. Hopefully I can get through the list without messing anyone up. Fulcrum, David S., Daniel Nightweaver, Capenna, Richard J., TJT, AK Music Lover, Barney D., Azzle Razzle, Blade of Anderil, Lori B., Norwegian Myar, Mason Weathertop, Gimli a Break, Divine Madman, Rosie Rose, The Bestest Boy, Who On Is My Hero, Aldarion Is Right, Avarial, I messed that one up, Party Snacks, Norwegenius, Bruce W., Artemis, Kira C., Das S., Hunter T., Silver Star, Silver Hobbit, and my name is August West. Thank you so much for your continued support. I hope you all have a wonderful rest of your week. I'll be back talking more about Chapter 3 of The Fellowship of the Ring next time, and I'll see you then. Stay safe out there.
Thanks for listening to the Lord of the Rings Lorecast. If you'd like to learn more about other fantasy worlds, check out my other podcasts, The Elder Scrolls Lorecast, The Witcher Lorecast, and more at robotsradio.net. If you'd like to reach out, I'd love to hear from you. Send me a note on Twitter at robots_radio, or join our amazing community on the Robots Radio Discord. There are links in the show notes, or just search Robots Radio Discord, or find the link on robotsradio.net. I'll see you next time.